Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Populism. Well, strictly speaking, what's the problem with it? Because strictly speaking, populism is basically defined by, quote, a political approach that strives to appeal to ordinary people who feel that their concerns are disregarded by established elite groups, end quote. Well, but of course, the problem isn't popular discontent and alienation itself. That makes perfect sense in a world of unacceptable inequality. The problem is that political leaders don't just appeal to populism. They pervert it. They exploit it. They use its darker forces towards injustice rather than actually solving people's actual problems. Now, I say all this because our guest today has thought deeply about why populism is bubbling up across many Western democracies now and really what to do about it. So this hour on Point, demagogues and populists and the reasons they sometimes take over politics. And you can join us. Do you see populism on the rise across Western democracies here in the United States? Does it make sense? What's driving it? And if so, how do we take care of the underlying issues that are driving a rise in populism? Well, Michael Lind joins us today. He's a professor at the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His new book is The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Michael Lind, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, just sort of lay out your argument, if you could. What do you think, you know, are the main drivers of what seems to be a rise in populism in some Western democracies?
Well, when you look at societies in which you have demagogic populists claiming to be the champions of the disfranchised masses against an insider power elite, they tend to have certain characteristics. For example, the American South between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Revolution, some of the big cities in the North in the early 20th century when a lot of European immigrant populations and also African American migrants were disfranchised effectively, even if they formally had the vote. You know, in many countries around the world, and including in Central and Latin America. And what you see is a lack of institutions that can incorporate and amplify the voices of ordinary people. In the past, I argue in my book, The New Class War, in the mid-20th century United States, those were represented by trade unions, by local political party networks and machines, and by churches and synagogues, which were more powerful in our less secular society 50 years ago. As these institutions that incorporated high school educated working class people have atrophied, power has shifted upwards to the university educated managerial and professional elite, not as a result of a conspiracy particularly, but just because that class, the class to which I belong, tends to be much better organized and networked than those below. So it creates these conditions of alienation and isolation in which people either tune out of politics or they cast protest votes, often for demagogic populists.
So, of course, the institutions, though, amongst the ones that you named, religious institutions, local sort of party machines, labor organizations, they've all atrophied for different reasons, though. Some of them, I think you could arguably say, have atrophied because the elite wanted that to happen. I'm thinking particularly of organized labor.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. If you look at religion, there's a long-term trend towards secularization in the Western world, and it's more advanced in Europe than it is in the United States, but the U.S. is catching up, and that's a long-term social trend, and I don't think the elite is behind it in particular. But as you point out, the elites, not only in the Republican Party in the late 20th century, but also so-called New Democrats like Bill Clinton, were hostile or indifferent at best to labor unions. And as I point out in the New Class War, they used global labor arbitrage, that is shutting down factories in the U.S. and then opening up new ones to exploit a lower wage labor abroad, to devastate much of the industrial workforce in America. And you see the same pattern in Europe. I think one thing that you can't overlook is the heartlands of populism in the U.S., in Britain, in Germany, in France, they tend to be deindustrialized regions. Mm-hmm. Where the local working class is not entirely white working class, but disproportionately white, was represented by social democratic parties of the center left and by trade unions. And as those have disintegrated, the vacuum has been filled by right-wing populists.
So I think let's step back here for a second and get some definitions from you in order to help better understand the argument that you're making here. So first of all, when we're talking about groups of people, working class, who may be turning towards populism. How are you defining the classes here?
Well, I use an educational rather than a financial definition of class status. To my mind, the greatest cleavage in modern Western societies is between the roughly one-third of people who have a bachelor's degree or above. You only get about 10% of people have an advanced graduate or professional degree, and about 7 out of 10 Americans, and the numbers are similar in Western Europe, who have no education beyond high school or the equivalent. And this is a real class difference, because the bosses, the people who give orders, the people who run things, particularly the large organizations that dominate the economy, the government, the nonprofit sector, the media sector, the bosses have usually not only college diplomas but advanced and professional degrees.
So we're looking at education there as being the bifurcating metric. Okay. And then so when we also say managerial elite, are they geographically located? I mean, you said that it's probably not – it's not just one party or the other. Who are the managerial elite?
Well, in the New Class War, I argue that this political geography that we see on both sides of the Atlantic, where you have the center-left parties, which increasingly represent the college-educated elite, along with minorities and immigrants, tend to be clustered into what I call the hub cities. These are large cities connected to the world economy: New York, San Francisco, Boston, Austin increasingly, London, Paris. They're surrounded by – it's not so much countryside as by low-density suburbs and exurbs, where most of the local working class, non-white as well as white, tends to live simply because they can't afford to live and work in the rather expensive hub cities. So you have a situation in which the elites, if they're not born into these hub cities, talented, upwardly mobile people who get expensive educations tend to migrate to them wherever they're born in the country.
So I think one of the things that I'm struggling with in trying to really understand the lessons to draw from your book, Michael, is when we use the words elite when talking about college-educated Americans. I mean, college-educated Americans span a very large and broad group of people. I mean, you as you know, there's been some pushback to your book amongst reviewers. One of them in particular, the New York Times, said, well, we're talking about school teachers too who are college-educated. Are they part of this managerial elite?
Well look, I'm talking about the major structure. Obviously, there are exceptions. If you're a barista with a PhD in Icelandic literature, you're not part of the economic or social elite. Conceivably, you could be a high school dropout and you win a lottery ticket and become a millionaire. So it's not the exceptions, you know, that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the rule. And the rule is that people with institutional and organizational authority overwhelmingly have college credentials. And not only that, if you look at the top 10% of the U.S. in terms of education, that is those with graduate and professional degrees, they have about half of the wealth in the United States. The other half is divided among the 90% below them and the very top 1% of the super rich. So, you know, we can play semantic games about, you know, poor professors, you know, and rich ditch diggers, but I don't think that's relevant to the main point.
Yeah, I mean, I asked you about that though because when you when we're talking about the possibility of a new class war, right, which is the title of your book, I think. Again, for me, just trying to understand the lessons to draw, it's important to understand sort of who is the war between, because my sense is that there's actually quite a large group of Americans in the middle of what this war may be shaping up to be.
Well, one of the views of the center left is that the so-called PMC, the professional managerial class, these tend to be academics, independent professionals, lawyers, and so on, is a distinct class from the rich, from the billionaires. And as I point out in the New Class War, almost all of the billionaires we have in the United States, there are a few who were born to great wealth, but the vast majority of rich people, Silicon Valley and Wall Street, were not born super rich, but they were born into college-educated households. So, you know, to my mind, that's an interesting debate, but I still think the basic divide is between the college-educated and the 70% or so who lack those credentials.
Yeah. So let me briefly ask you, do you see or did you see a version of this class war being played out in terms of how people voted in the 2016 election here in the United States?
Well, you see it both in the United States and abroad. Trump did particularly well, and the Republicans have been doing better and better with high school educated white working class Americans, but also with nearly a third of Hispanic Americans who have been trending towards the Republican Party. You see the same thing with the Brexit vote. The single clearest link to Brexit voting was one's educational status.
Mm. Well, there's a lot more to dig into when we come back. We're talking with Michael Lind. His new book is The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. Do you think that the managerial elite, as Michael Lind describes it, is the thing that's breaking down U.S. democracy? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Michael Lind. His new book is The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And we're happy to hear your questions as well for Michael Lind. Do you see a politics of anger on the rise in the United States across Western democracies? What can we do about it? Now, Michael Lind, there's a lot to dig into with your book, but I just have one more question about this, the educational divide, because it is so important in terms of how you're looking at who the combatants are, if I could put it that way, in this new class war that you write about. Because I was looking at a Pew study of verified voters from the 2016 election here in the United States, and they found that of the folks who voted for Hillary Clinton, all of them across races, that 28% of those folks had a high school degree or less. And of those who voted for President Trump, 34% had a high school degree or less. So a 6-point difference there, which actually, again, across races isn't as big as one might expect, given the kind of discontent and drivers that you're talking about.
Well, my argument is not that one party represents the working class and the other the elite. Obviously, there are racial and ethnic and regional and religious divides. And particularly in the New Class War, I talk about the division between immigrants and native minorities on the one hand, who tend to vote increasingly as allies of the hub city professional class, the native white professional class, against, on the other side, conservative populist parties, which represent the mostly, not exclusively, white native working class. So there are deep, you know, enduring racial divisions. Part of that I explain by the fact that if you look at particularly these deindustrialized regions, you have the older manufacturing working class and their neighbors have a sense of downward mobility as their economies, local regional economies, have been devastated by globalization and by other change. If you're an immigrant, whether to the United States or Britain or Germany, even if you are paid fairly low wages with low benefits, in many cases you're better off. You know, and you can aspire for a better life for yourself and your descendants. So my argument is not that our present class, our present party politics is going to be aligned along class. If that happened, then the working class party would win every single election because it's the overwhelming majority of the population.
So then if that's not what your argument is, what is your argument in the affirmative then?
Well, my argument is that we are going to be trapped in a doom loop between a kind of what I call technocratic neoliberalism, a sort of insider politics, which is tends to be bipartisan. It was represented by the so-called third way of Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, which overlapped enormously when it came to policies towards trade, immigration, regulation, unions. It overlapped with the economic conservatism of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And so, you know, that's one pole. And at the other extreme, you get figures like Donald Trump, like Nigel Farage in Britain, more than Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson is more of a mainstream figure. Matteo Salvini, a demagogic populist in Italy. And I argue that in the book that both technocratic neoliberalism and demagogic populism are two roads to hell. We don't want to take either road. What we want is to restore what I call democratic pluralism, something like the New Deal in the post-war United States and its equivalents abroad.
So that's where your book starts, right? In an exploration in terms of the conditions that brought about the New Deal. So walk us through there. What lessons should we be particularly attuned to? I mean, you call it the prelude to the New Deal being the first class war.
That's right. What I'm calling the new class war now is actually the second class war. The classes being industrial workers and service workers. Classes which didn't really exist on large scale before the 19th century industrial revolution, and the managerial elite, which succeeded the older so-called bourgeois elite of small-scale capitalists, owner-operators, that is the managers of big firms as well as big government bureaucracies, big nonprofits, largely as a result of the need to mobilize the Western democracies in World War II. To defeat Germany and its allies, the U.S., Britain, and then after 1945, other Western democracies imposed a class peace. Political scientists call it a settlement that lasted for about 30, 40 years after 1945, and corporations were compelled to share power, often reluctantly, with labor unions through institutionalized negotiations. You had universal suffrage for the first time after World War II by the 1960s with the dismantling of racist restrictions on voting in the South. And so you had these institutions that empowered working class people of all races to the extent that that had not been the case before 1945. And increasingly, I argue that it has not been the case since the 1980s and 90s and 2000s.
Mm. And we also had, at the same time, the rise of fascism in Europe, right? So there was an immediate example of sort of one of those poles that you were talking about that one presumes the United States did not want to head towards.
Well, that's absolutely right. In the new class war, I argue that however important grassroots mobilizations from below are, you need to have reformist elements of the national establishment support those efforts, whether they're civil rights efforts, whether it's pro-union efforts, in the interest of the nation. And those reformist elements of the national elite usually have the most success when there's some kind of external enemy, whether it was the fascist dictatorships in World War II or the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The reformists could then argue to big business, for example, that you have to restrain yourself. You can't just crush labor, right? We need to have – and alternately, in wartime, President Roosevelt, for example, President Truman would try to restrain labor unions, saying, you know, we'll protect your interests, but we can't have strikes disrupting war production. So one of the lessons of history is that in periods when the external threat fades, as it did for a decade or two after the Cold War, then the inhibitions on the powerful, and particularly on employers and on business, to restrain themselves and not just to crush the working class, those inhibitions fade as well.
Mm. Well, let's go to our callers. Jim's calling from Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, Magna. I haven't read Mr. Lind's book, but I've tried to imbibe as much of his arguments as I can secondhand. And it appears to me that Mr. Lind is conflating the idea of the educational or cultural elites with that of the economic elites, and thereby giving an inappropriate cover or even excuse for the motivations of Trump voters, which really are much more base and undignified than that, and really are motivated by racial, religious, cultural anxieties at the prospect of a changing America. I see Mr. Lind's work as being somewhat in the vein of the media's habit since the election of grossly overdiagnosing the role of economic anxiety in turning people out to vote for Trump.
Mm. Well, Jim, thank you for your call. Michael Lind, would you like to respond to him?
Well, yeah, with a question. If all Trump voters, and for that matter, voters for populists in Europe, had a moral conversion tomorrow and became completely anti-racist, would only one party govern in every democracy? It's a serious question. I was on a panel with Michael Kazin and with E.J. Dionne in Washington some time ago, and they said, well, the only motive of Trump voters is racism. And then they generalized that to Republican voters in general. So I asked my friends Michael Kazin and E.J. Dionne, and I'm not a Republican. I'm very critical of the Republicans. I said, is it really your theory that if racism disappeared tomorrow, the Democratic Party would win 100% of elections at all levels, that no one has any motive other than hating non-white people not to vote for Democrats? And I'm afraid, I'm sorry, I think this is a superficial partisan explanation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously, as I've discussed, there are racial and ethnic divides within the working class and between natives and immigrants. I discussed that in detail in my book. But simply reducing populism to hatred implies that there are no other possible motives, including concern about deindustrialization, concern about your religious values. Many progressives tend to assume that people can't be serious about abortion. If you're a devoutly religious Catholic or Protestant and you believe abortion is murder, you may agree with the Democrats on 100% of other issues, but you're going to vote against them. So I reject this idea that there's a single explanation, while I say in the book, ethnic and racial anxiety, is always part of human behavior, but it's one of many different motives.
So, Jim, thank you for that call. Michael Lind, I don't think I agree. We should not ever be so reductive that we presume that one factor animates any particular American, right? You have my complete agreement on that. But on this question of race, I do want to just sort of dig in a little bit more here because, again, and as it plays out or played out in the 2016 election, because that's just sort of, the framework that most of us can easily access here, amongst non-college graduate voters in America, okay, all of non-college graduate voters in America who cast a ballot in 2016. For non-college graduate whites, 64% of them voted for Donald Trump. But amongst non-college graduate minorities or non-whites, 77% of them voted for Hillary Clinton. I mean, they are almost exactly mirror images of each other.
What's
the explanation for that?
Well, let me correct you there. There's no such thing as non-whites. This is not a group. This is a statistical abstraction. There are African Americans. There are Latino or Hispanic Americans. And there are Asian and Pacific Islanders. You don't get any data if you just say non-whites combined, where you're combining affluent Indian Americans with recent Guatemalan immigrants. This is a meaningless statistic. Now, if you want to look at a meaningful statistic that's relevant to this, ask yourself, why did 29% of Hispanic Americans vote for Donald Trump? And why do the Republicans get between a quarter and a third of the Hispanic vote in every election? I don't see how that can be explained. Are these self-hating Hispanics, right? Are they anti-Hispanic Hispanics? Now, so clearly, if you look at Britain, black and Middle Eastern voters, BAME voters, as they say in the UK, cast one-third of the votes for Brexit. So if Brexit was just white racism and anti-immigrantism, then why did a third of black and Middle Eastern voters support Brexit?
I can't answer that question, but I do want to just dig in a little further here when you say that we can't talk about non-whites as a group. But
it's a statistical abstraction.
But I'm quoting some numbers here from Pew, and I guess they were attempting to say, are white voters in a statistical abstraction as well, Michael Lind?
Yes, I would argue that a lot of this political science is based on too few categories. So, for example, the term non-Hispanic white excludes people of Latin American descent who are, call themselves white, when they answer the census. It includes groups as different as Arab Americans, as Norwegian Americans, and Polish Americans. Now, to lump Arab Americans, Polish Americans, and Norwegian Americans into a generic non-Hispanic white group, you'll get some interesting data from that, but it will be largely useless. So I think what we need to do is, and the good pollsters do this, they break this down. I mean, learning how Catholic American, European Americans in, let's say, the Rust Belt vote tells you something, but lumping those voters together with old stock, Southern Baptists in Mississippi, and then whatever the average of those two groups is some number. I just think you end up being confused.
Well, so, I mean, Pew has those numbers, too, by religious denomination, actually. I mean, this is fascinating. And the reason why I want to explore this is because I just really think it's important for us when we're considering your whole thesis here to understand who we're talking about, right? So Pew says amongst Catholics, those self-identified Catholics in America who also identify as Hispanic, so Catholic Hispanics, 78% of them said they voted for Hillary Clinton. But white Catholics, 64% of them voted for Donald Trump. Is there any conclusion to be drawn from that?
Well, yes. It reinforces the analysis of geography and ethnic voting in my book, The New Class War, where I argue that the basic party structure that is emerging in the North America and Western Europe, you have the hub cities where the upper middle class white professionals and managers tend to be concentrated pursuing their trades. In some cases, you have old stock native minorities like African Americans in those same cities. But also that's where most of the jobs for recent immigrants are, who tend to be unskilled. Some of them are very skilled. But, performing service jobs in these big expensive cities like New York and London and Boston, because that's where the money is. And they're largely doing services. In some cases, they're literally servants for the affluent college-educated class. And so that's why these are immigrant magnets. You know, there are not a whole lot of maid jobs and dog walker jobs in working class, you know, suburban and small town communities. So I think you have to look at the whole picture of, you know, what the occupations are, what the ethnic groups are, and what the class is, rather than just look at single characteristics taken out of context.
We're talking with Michael Lind. His new book is The New Class War: Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Michael Lind. He's a professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's out with a really fascinating new book. It's called The New Class War: Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. And Professor Lind, I promise you we're going to get to an exploration of some of your ideas on how to solve this class war as you write about it. But I have to say I'm a little confused by something that we were left with in the last segment of the conversation. I'm hoping you can clarify here. Because on the one hand, earlier in the show and in the book, you say that one of the ways that you're defining this class war is by degree of college education, that there's this college-educated managerial elite and then a non-college-educated working-class group of Americans as well. So that's a pretty simple bifurcation here. But then later in the conversation, you kind of rejected other ways to look at groups as being overly simplistic. So I can't really quite square the two in my mind.
Yeah. In my book, I argue for a three-way class conflict. That is, the working class is split in Western democracies between the mostly white, not exclusively white, native working class, and immigrants and their descendants, their immediate descendants. And this is a political divide, as we discussed earlier. It's also a class divide because they tend to be in different occupations, different parts of the country. The immigrants, as I mentioned, tend to be concentrated in the big, expensive hub cities rather than in the less expensive, more working class exurbs and suburbs and rural areas. And so, you know, that's one of the great sources of great tension, and it permits unscrupulous politicians, whether they're demagogic populists or members of the establishment, to pit these different groups within the working class against each other, playing up the cleavages, and race is one, but also religion and nationality and region. You know, these are all cleavages that politicians can use to play different groups against each other.
So then in this framework, though, where does that leave working class African Americans? They sound like they're completely forgotten in this framework.
Well, working class African Americans, as I point out in the book, are at this point mostly suburban. So there's this kind of 50 years out of date assumption that urban means African American. The vast majority of African Americans in 2020 are high school educated, working class. They live in relatively inexpensive suburbs and exurbs. And they're the great division there politically, and it's the deepest division among ethnic groups in the United States, is African Americans vote like 10% Republican and about 90% Democratic. That goes all the way back to Goldwater and to the opposition of conservative Republicans, not of liberal Republicans, to the Civil Rights Act, and also to the fact that for decades afterwards, Republicans did, and to some extent still do, you know, make kind of coded appeals to race. But I think it's a myth. And again, this is why I'm criticizing the idea of non-whites as a generic group, to say that, well, American politics is as divided along – is completely polarized along racial lines. The black-white division between Democrats and Republicans is the most extreme. The Asian Americans, it's much less divided. They favor the Democrats now, but it's nothing like 10% to 90%. And as I've mentioned repeatedly, Hispanic Americans are about a quarter to a third, consistently support Republicans. And, you know, it's not 50-50, but also it's not extreme polarization.
Mm. And the reason why I asked that question is because, as you described, you're talking about a mostly white working class that's potentially being pitted against either new immigrants or first or second generation immigrants. You saw that as a one place where a wedge can be driven by demagogic leaders, as you said. And
exactly.
Yeah. It made me wonder, though, like, again, we can't forget that there are millions of Americans who fall under the broad rubric of African American working class as well. And I'm just wondering how they fit into your bigger picture here about, you know, what this class war is and how we get out of it.
Well, my solutions include rebuilding collective bargaining, organized labor, which is transracial. And it would benefit the most recent immigrants as well as the most old stock white poor in Appalachia. That is, if we could rebuild collective bargaining and labor power, you know, when I talk about rebuilding the power of civic organizations, including churches, you have to remember African Americans tend to be more church-going and religious than whites, particularly college-educated whites. And somewhat more socially conservative. So, you know, when I've been criticized for neglecting the interests of African Americans with my emphasis on trade unions and churches, you know, it's puzzling to me because the two greatest civil rights leaders of the 20th century, A. Philip Randolph and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., were respectively a labor union leader. Mm. A. Philip Randolph founded and led the Railway Porters Union, and a church pastor, Dr. King.
Well, let's go to the callers. Let's go to James, who's calling from Wausau, Wisconsin. James, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I've been in the organized labor for 42 years. I started fresh out of high school at 19 years old, making $8.26 an hour back in 1977 with pension and health care. And I seen it go through Carter, Reagan, and I seen once Reagan, you know, it kind of the neoliberals got in there, it just kind of went downhill, you know, and chipped away at us more and more. And I think it's not so much that we're against race. I'm not racist one bit. And I think this is America. We all have equal opportunity. And it seems it's the corporate structure. And, you know, we don't mind a person getting rich in this country. Make as much money as you want. Just don't hurt others while you, you know, just take advantage of others while you get there. That's what we don't like in this country. And we need, you know, we need to show dignity, respect, and to the working, because it's an essential part of society, you know. Managers are an essential part, too. And they're caught up in the corporate.
James, it looks like, I'm so sorry to have to jump in here, but it looks like we're losing your call here. But Michael Lind, James provides us the perfect segue to talk about sort of how you advise getting out of this class war. And let's spend some time focusing on labor in particular, because all the numbers absolutely show that for 40, 50 years, we've had a consistent reduction in the share of wealth in this country going to labor, right? I mean, that's kind of beyond question now. But how do we then move towards what essentially you call a tripartite system of sharing wealth and power if we have so many lawmakers, so many laws, both at the federal and state level, and even just industry, all now, after 50 years, built in a way that makes it very hard to grow the power of labor?
Well, that's absolutely right. There's a more or less direct correlation, and even some, you know, intellectually honest conservatives admit this, between inequality and labor union membership in the United States, and inequality has skyrocketed as private sector labor union membership has collapsed to almost 6%. Now, in the new class war, I argue that there's no way to save the existing enterprise bargaining system of collective bargaining that the U.S. inherited from the New Deal in the 1940s. It's just too difficult to unionize every plant, every firm, you know, business by business by business. Where unionization has taken root and endures in Europe and other countries is where you have sectoral bargaining. That is, you have all representatives of all of the employers in a sector, all of the labor in a sector, you know, maybe sometimes consumers, public interest advocates as well, get together and negotiate minimum wages, benefits, working hours appropriate to that sector. And there's a kind of a minor renaissance. It's very hopeful. Obviously, it's small. In this approach today, with support both from maverick conservatives like Orrin Cass, who was Romney's chief economic advisor, and also many progressives like those of the Roosevelt Institute in New York, who have put forth some interesting ideas about so-called alt labor. Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York recently revived an old 1930s institution, the wage board, to have this kind of sectoral bargaining in the case of fast food workers. So you're not going to undo half a century of corporate assaults on labor overnight. Yeah. But if you look at the polls, it's very encouraging. Majority of Americans, as not Republicans, interestingly, as well as Democrats, now will tell pollsters they think organized labor plays a useful role. And this has changed since the Great Recession.
Why? I mean, I wonder, because not only has that changed, we've also heard, we're hearing more and more like the elite of the economic elite, billionaires saying, well, maybe capitalism as we know it isn't quite working for most people, right? I'm just, and in part, when after you ask them why they think that now, it's because they're scared. They're scared now that people are willing to sort of vote in ways that they may not necessarily approve of, or may lead us down further down the road of a negative form of populism. Is that fear enough to bring all these people back to the bargaining table to rethink or think through some new models, as you've just described to us?
Well, it certainly helps. John F. Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, the Wall Street financier, was asked in the 1930s why he supported Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. And he said, I'd give up half of my fortune if I were allowed to keep the other half. So I'm not looking to a great moral reformation on the part of the elite, but to enlighten self-interest and the realization that to preserve some of their privileges, they're going to have to make some concessions to the people below them. Now, I think the big divide that we have to keep our eyes on when it comes to affluent people and rich people rethinking whether capitalism is working for the rest or not is, there's always been a tendency among the rich in the United States, going back to Andrew Carnegie, to say, yes, it's true, inequality is terrible, but the way to deal with it is through charity. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, so – and there's even a kind of indirect charity. I would argue ideas about a universal basic income are like this. We'll simply have a small number of people who get most of the gains from economic growth, but then we'll tax them and we'll give everybody $1,000 a month or something like that. Historically, labor activists and unions in both Europe and America have opposed basic income ideas because they see it as a form of charity mediated by the state. They think there's nothing wrong with working, including at the jobs that are mostly being created now in the United States, which are in retail, leisure, hospitality, and home health care. There's no reason those should not be well-paying, dignified jobs, and they need to be upgraded and paid better. But that would be preferable, at least that's the typical social democratic pro-labor view, rather than just have people work in low-wage, dead-end jobs and then have the government send them a check every month.
Michael Lind, the title of your book is The New Class War. And I'm just – there's one reviewer noted that it's not class struggle. Is the only way out of this some kind of intense internal conflict?
No, on the contrary. I could have called it the new class compromise.
Okay.
Because my argument is that the U.S. and other Western democracies flourished after World War II when the class war was moderated by class peace treaties, by interclass compromises. And we've had lower productivity growth, increasing inequality, all sorts of social dysfunction as that post-World War II class compromise broke down. So the argument is that it would be a disaster to have a continuing class war. It would also be a disaster for one class to wipe out the other one. The managerial class needs the working class majority, and we need managers, we need experts, we need investors, we need capitalists as long as they're restrained. So the book is a plea to end the new class war with negotiations that lead to a new cross-class compromise.
Well, and so then this is why the middle of the last century, I pause when thinking of it as an example, because we didn't have an internal war. We had an external one. We had a world war to sort of refocus everyone's minds here. I don't think anyone wants that now. So what can we do to get the managerial elite, as you call them, to see that the good of the nation going forward requires some new meaningful compromise?
Well, we don't want to declare World War III as an excuse to rebuild labor, obviously.
Right.
But nevertheless, there are long-term projects that the nation can commit itself to that will require cross-class collaboration. One is ordinary peaceful economic development, including economic competition with other countries, which, you know, doesn't need to take warlike forms, but it means that the government has an interest in promoting technological development with labor as well as capital taking part. On the left, proponents of a Green New Deal call for a quasi-warlike mobilization. Whether that's realistic or not, you know, that would provide the context in which the government could say, okay, look, workers and capitalists and managers are members of the same team working for a common goal, and there needs to be mutual understanding and negotiation and compromise rather than constant strife.
We have 30 seconds left, Michael Lynn. My last question for you is, do you think American politics as it is now can actually do this?
No, but politics is constantly changing, and the country has moved so far in my lifetime. I was born into segregated Texas in 1962. That I think it will, you know, the pendulum swings, and there will be a period of construction and renewal after a period of disintegration.
Well, Michael Lynn's new book is The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Lynn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.